Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. Today, we are powered by Onnit, where Onnit's mission is to peak performance through a combination of unique products and actionable information. They even have this academy on Onnit.com, which is really amazing, full of all kinds of information that you could use to create competence, to promote action in your life while taking advantage of all of the Earth-grown nutrient products that they use. So they put together kind of leading edge science with earth grown nutrients, some time tested strategies, and they even use top athletes and medical professionals to test them, use them, see how they are. But Onnit is dedicated. They provide their customers with all kinds of new supplements, foods, fitness equipment, even, and they're really out to help people. I mean, it's why Onnit is the total human optimization website. I use their products daily. Alpha Brain I take daily. Himalayan salt daily. Earth grown nutrients I take daily. Krill oil I take. They're all in the cognitive cave, if you will. But definitely check out their website. All kinds of supplements and foods even. HempForce. I've switched from the whey-based protein to a vegetable-based protein or a plant-based protein. Basically so I'm not farting all the fucking time. But all kinds of things. I use their MCT oil in my coffee. They even sell coffee. Caveman coffee is what I'm drinking in here. But the Warrior Bars I love as well. All kinds of foods that you can definitely try out. You know, it doesn't have to work for you because they'll even tell you if it doesn't work for you, you use it. It was shit for you. Even if it's their pills, or some of the, earth-grown nutrient pills is what I should say because it's non-synthetic or their supplements like New Mood or Alpha Brain. If you don't like it, the shit doesn't work for you, send it back and they give you a full refund. There's no fuckery going on, all right? And fuckery stealing from Joe Rogan's words, but most of you associate Onnit with Joe Rogan already. So, I love their products. I'm a huge fan. I even have a couple of their kettlebells. Jim and Dale are hanging out in the cognitive cave with me all the time when they're not being slung around. But check out Onnit. And if you actually go to adamlowry.com or cognitiverampage.com and find the Onnit logo, click through on there and make your first order. And when you do that, you'll get initial discounts up front and everything too. And you'll help support the Cognitive Rampage podcast. So, get on it. My guest on the podcast today is Glenn Marshall, host of the Addictive Podcast on iTunes. He's a multi-systemic adolescent behavior therapist and an addiction therapist. He runs the Addictive Podcast, like I just said, which is about functional and dysfunctional drug use. He spent a lot of time in Hawaii, now on his way to D.C. to try to change some policies. He is another soldier in the fight to end the drug war, just like we are at the Cognitive Rampage. I love his podcast. I think you should really check out the Addictive Podcast. A real education and a walk down what drugs, treatment, and recovery really are. And that's what we talk about on the podcast. We go on for a while. We get deep into it. We talk about issues with 12 steps. We talk about issues with chemical incarceration. We talk about all, just about every angle of recovery, addiction that there kind of is. We touch the cusp of a lot of things, but I really enjoyed having Glenn Marshall on. You will see him on the show again. I just enjoy talking to him. I enjoyed his passion, his enthusiasm to try to change this and end this war on drugs, educate people. And it was great talking to another Florida boy who's actually originally from Coconut Grove, Miami, who moved out to Hawaii, et cetera, but now is on to DC, like I said. But we went on for a while and it was really good. It was informative. I loved hearing his passion and enthusiasm for change, but you'll hear it in him as well. I hope you enjoy Glenn Marshall. Usually starts out by asking the wrong question, and then it cuts to Bush Senior, and he goes, "Well, who is to blame?" And then after you point out the wrong question, then it's to now point out and ostracize whoever it is that we need to be mad at. Then he goes, "Whoever uses drugs is the enemy." Then I swear to God, dude, and he walks through these stages of how we've gotten to here, and I'm watching it, yelling at it, and like you said, they're just locking people up, they milk them, and a long story short, what we're doing is going the bottom half of the poor
10 and 15% of America are no longer needed. The plants are closed. No more car plants. They're going down. So we don't need the poor, uneducated 10, 15%. So let's see if we can make money on them. They start the war on drugs. Everybody's locked up. And now you get where we're at today.
It's horrific to even think about, right? And you know, I always try to, I used to think it was just sort of fucking plain old-fashioned racism until I read that The Alchemy of
Evil. Well, now, brother, I mean, methamphetamine and white trailer parks, I mean, that's it.
Man, and all these fucking things are just chemicals, right? They're, you know, Dioxin. Go get the methamphetamine from the pharmacy. It's
We have a fucking war on symptoms. That's what we have.
Yeah. Dude, that's a great way to look at it, actually. We have a war on symptoms. That's so true. Even in working with the kids, right? If you have a behavioral problem and you're outbursting or some shit, well, you're going to get attention. Are you fucking depressed and just sort of keeping it to yourself and you're getting sexually abused at home? Bro, nobody's paying attention to you.
Nope. And you know what? And it's the fucking parents.
Pure effects, they're a big part of it. And, you're saying in that case, yeah. I mean, dude, it's so dark. It's, I don't know what the fuck to say. I mean,
but you're doing it. You're starting it. I think you're part of it, right? You started the Addictive Podcast because you saw the bullshit. You're really fighting policy. Doing it, dude. So, I mean, those out there like you that are picking up the microphone, that have the education, that have the experience, and are saying, fuck this. That's where it starts, man.
Bro, make that change. You know, just like I listen to you, Adam, if there's someone else, there is somebody else right now who is on the tipping point, man. They are moving through Prochaska and DeClementi stages of change. They are in the fucking planning stage. They're looking at that fucking action step, baby. Take that fucking action step. You will feel like $1 million. You'll get in shape. You'll feel amazing. You'll fucking help people. Bro, it is the greatest feeling to move into like some kind of advocacy or sticking your head out of the fucking sandwich. I've been 20 years on the fucking hiding out from that shit. And now I'm like, fuck, bro. No more fucking hiding. It's time to rise up.
Woo. And, you know, yeah. Andrew Mariotti was a guest and he got inspired and he's doing his thing. But, I want to go in your mind for a minute, man.
Sure.
You're telling people, to get going. Where were you at in your life, I guess, just before you decided to really say, fuck that, I got to join the fight?
Just what am I doing? My same old little intensive home-based therapy. I work for an agency in Hawaii. Actually, it was also another connector, right? So my family's, I'm 42. My fucking dad slips on the ice. My stepdad slips on the ice and fucking cracks his head. And he actually went through some crazy surgery. Dude, my mom, this is also part of my lobbying campaign. My mom has this Lyme disease. Her fucking hands can hardly open sometimes. She gets all these crazy symptoms. And she's also like searching for CBD oil and shit like that. So I'm moving into the DC area right now. I'm building out my barn apartment, dude. That's my fucking right. So look at how I'm even setting up my life, right? In Hawaii, I fucking spend my wife and I spend all our fucking money on the rent, dude, like all of it. And so I'm moving out of there, been over there a long time, and I'll be moving 40 minutes outside DC, right down 66.
Fucking Hawaii to DC, bro.
Dude, fucking, it's so beautiful in Virginia, man. It's so beautiful.
My buddy Greg Sims lives up there. Sorry, man. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So my mother, my stepfather, they get this nice piece, 25 acres of land, beautiful. They got this barn up there. So, dude, I'm finishing out the top of this barn. And again, that's also to kind of insulate me, right? So notice, I'm so fucking passionate about this. I'm even setting up my life to sort of, keep bills low and sort of have like some immunity. Bro, I'm sure if everything gets going, there's going to be fucking attacking, right? There's some line that says like, if you're saying something that's not pissing somebody off, it's just fucking like, it's just like, you're just pitching some bullshit or whatever. And
I used to tell my patients, if you don't tell me fuck you within the first week, I'm not doing my job.
Yeah, well, yeah, because I mean, that's change, right? Change is never comfortable. It comes with sort of this, it's an abrasive, like, fucking terrible process. Not pleasant. And so, dude, in Hawaii, it was so nice, like, you know, just having things the way they are. And then I sort of moved out, right? I was an addiction counselor and doing all that shit, and then moved into, like...
So you were doing addiction, that's right. You were treating that. There is a major meth problem.
Yeah, so I was running an outpatient, an intensive outpatient program, and that was just... You know, I mean, that is what it is. But then, dude, I opened the first methadone clinic in Kona, Hawaii.
No shit.
Fuck yeah. And so we had that shit going, and I had my clinical director, my nursing staff, and all that shit. And dude, we were fucking saving lives, man. Of all the people who lived in Kona used to have to drive all the way over to Hilo, and fucking Big Island's like huge, dude, right? Shitty Saddle Road, even at that point, bro. People's cars are fucking falling apart making that drive. And they would, imagine this, man, when you think about methadone, right? They were making that drive 2.5 hours every goddamn day, right? This is pre-take-home era, right? There was no take-homes or none of that shit, and they would be driving, and dude, they'd be holding down jobs. So they'd start their fucking drive, 5 a.m., what am I saying, 4 a.m. maybe, 4:30 a.m., go to Hilo, get their dose, come back, get ready, go to work, and do that shit every damn day. And so we opened the first clinic, first methadone clinic. And dude, we used to dose Orlam too, which is amazing medicine, right? These super fucking long acting metabolites. You could dose even like 2 times a week. Some patients would be on, or, you know, average is like 3 times a week. Just great. But it had like some liver issue, whatever. But then, but dude, so many people, man, you would see when that place fucking closed down, they pulled the plug on it, the main, supporting agency out of Oahu, fuckers were dying, dude, like crazy, crazy dying. And then, you know, even the hepatitis, and, it was so messy. So anyway, so there was that. And then I got into, and then I was doing care coordination, statewide care coordination, for adolescent mental health. And that was cool. And then I moved into the agency I'm at now, which is like intensive home-based and multi-systemic therapy. And man, the difference between a drug-centric, drug-focused type of treatment to a comprehensive wraparound model was so fantastic and like illuminating. And stop looking at the fucking addict through just those eyes, right? Or, you know, and again, I hate the word addict. I'm just so used to saying that shit, you know, but,
I couldn't agree more with you, bro.
Yeah. But that full wrap model. And so, dude, I'm like fucking super nanny now. Like that's really my thing. It's like, I'm like a super nanny. Like they give me good hours and about 6 months to do this super intensive, comprehensive treatment in the kids' life at home, in the community, in their school. I'm setting them up with jobs. I'm working a medical angle. I'm working this fucking whole total holistic model of life restructuring. And when you think about addiction, and like having someone in a residential treatment center, and then you're, first of all, fucking adolescents, man, you put them in any kind of outpatient, their fucking drug use goes up due to contamination effect. Totally sucks.
You know what? Spend 2 seconds on that real quick, because people, yeah. I get fucking mad when people's young kids get addicted or try something and these parents ship them the fuck off.
Well, that's all they know. I mean, all you know is that you go here and this is going to happen. And yet all the same, you know, all right. And then we're going to go to 12-step meetings. First of all, man, if you're an adolescent, the fucking what's called contamination effect is terrible. And multisystemic therapy looks at this a lot. And there's a lot of research around this. But when you put a kid in to a peer group, and peer groups are wonderful. I mean, when you have good, positive peer, in fact, you'd be better off putting them in a decent social environment, I think, honestly, and having a good individual therapist pay a lot of attention to them. But when you put a fucking high-risk kid in with a bunch of other high-risk kids, well, what direction you think that little dynamic is going to go? And so in MST, we would fucking try to keep them out of those programs because we could work that shit so hard and get all these great supports and get their, you know, talking about Johann Hari and his book, right? That purpose and that connection with positive, good things, with college opportunities, with all of that shit. You can reset their entire community rather than just sending them one place and then them returning and being like, all right, go to meetings, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of interventions, for one. And then the idea of, and it is true, you were right, it's really all people know. And technically, it's what they've been sold. This is what you do. For me, an intervention is, this is the way I see it. All right. We've all gathered together here, all the ones that love you, and now we're going to read you shit on how shitty of a person you are. And then after you've taken it all, because you have to, we're going to show you how much we love you by telling you to get the fuck away from us for a while.
You know, and I'm all for, dude, I'm all for twisting different screws to make change, right? Again, we talked about change being this difficult process and whatever. I was just having the same, not a conversation, but a couple of tweets back and forth with Maya, I think her last name's Solovitz. You know who I'm talking about? She's like super drug policy leader. She was like a co-author of Dr. Hart's book and things like that, High Price. When he comes on, you can ask him about her, but I was saying the same thing, like, you know, first of all, let's start with interventions, okay? Number one, there is no fucking scientific basis for most drug treatment, okay? Like, number one, like, 28-day model, residential model, that comes out of an insurance policy fucking range, and that's what they would pay for, so therefore you get residential treatment.
I think I was talking to Chris Bell, who did Inpatient while he was shooting his film Prescription Thugs, but I think it was something where he was at Cliffside or something, Malibu, where if you stay 60 days or 90 days, it goes up by like 60%.
Oh, I don't know. I think you should. You should get sort of a bonus. Do they give you like a night? They put a fucking diamond necklace on your pillow and
Talking about your chances of actually staying clean in recovery go up 60%. I think by going 90 days, and then you were talking about how this non-scientific bullshit idea of 30 days.
Well, you know, dude, again, like different things are going to work for different people and getting taken out of the environment and whatever.
And I'm I don't want to sound like I'm a fucking.
Sure, no, dude, you and me both. We're both for shit. Put it this way, there isn't enough out there to be picky about, man. There aren't enough effective treatments that we can fucking afford to be picky. I'll take 28-day bullshit sometimes, you know, if that's what we got, that's what we got, and we'll go with that. But, dude, intervention. So I'm talking to Maya, and she's talking about something called CRAFT. You guys should all look this up, CRAFT intervention. And number one, don't panic, right? Chill the fuck out. And so, again, it's sort of the systemic intervention. It's more like nurturing but still motivating. You still want to generate change, right? Even with the kid therapy and the wraparound care, you still want to generate change, and there's different ways to do that. But to think that the best way to do that is to fucking rally around like the person, you know, big circle, everyone writes the letters. And that shit is, I mean, it's affecting when I watch it, no question about it, and that may help some.
Good TV.
Well, fucking good TV, and maybe it even helps someone. But dude, to not consider the individual on any goddamn therapy completely misses the point, right? You always got to look at who you're dealing with. It's just like drug effect, man. You can't determine drug effect without considering the individual who's taking it and their, you know, the set and setting of that person and all of that shit. So same with therapy. You must look at the individual. As much as you look at the model, anytime somebody is forcing their model down your throat and it's not working and they fucking blame you, well, smack that bitch in the mouth.
Dude, you know what? I'm glad you've actually helped me look at things a little different. I'm anti 12 steps, to be honest, and I have been for a while. But you know, the way you kind of talk about it and the more I've leaned toward, I got a friend of mine coming on Tuesday on the podcast who's a big time guy in the 12 steps and not to mention a very big dude. So I'm not going to talk a lot of shit. And I grew up with the guy. And, you know, I really backed off of that idea more because the truth is, if somersaults fucking help you, do that. So if 12 steps help you, fucking do that. And what I like what you say is there's not enough out there. And I think, and you hit the nail on the head, the biggest part I have about some parts of 12 steps, whatever, is the idea that if it fails you, you really failed. And that idea that you just said it, that we all know that therapy is individualized and certain things work for certain people. And so the part I didn't like about 12 steps was when they say, if 12 steps didn't work for you, then you didn't work the steps.
Gross. I mean, that's all therapies, right? Is a lot of therapies will talk about the idea of resistance and this type of shit. That's all bullshit, dude. That's all, you know, if a therapist is fucking missing the boat and they can't engage a client and their model isn't working and they hold on to that and then blame the client, dude, they're a shitty therapist. You guys should all check out Scott Miller, man, who he was at this big conference, you know, the something of psychotherapy. It's like they meet like once every 8 years. He did this speech. Look up effective treatment, Scott Miller, and YouTube. And how there's like zero correlation, or like the, like 5% of the actual therapeutic effect is accounted for like the model. Like it does nothing, dude. Absolutely fucking nothing. It's all about engagement. It's all about sort of mastery and expertise.
And that client therapist relationship, you got to have that trust.
That's what it's all about, buddy. We're all back to the fucking humanist, like, you know, good. And again, so you, and through that relationship, that's your carrier, right? So you're resonating therapeutically with the person. Your fucking hopefully healthy brain as a therapist is engaging with their sick brain. It's got, you know, you get a neurostabilization through that sort of experience. And then you're sort of floating your, you know, methods or models across that relationship, but the relationship, the therapeutic relationship, is by far and away the key, right? I mean, it's like the 12 step, right? You look at who that works for. Well, it's, you know, it seems to be, it probably has a lot to do with the fucking people who get in there really engaged and feel good about it, and it works for them and they like it and da 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 da. But if someone's not feeling that, you know, check out like Smart Recovery or one of those like non-religious based. I mean, you don't need to fucking, dude, curing addiction. You know, I've been on this tip, like how it's not a disease and all that shit. I've never thought it's a disease, and I call it, dude, my best word is it's a condition. It's a condition that happens under certain biopsychosocial circumstances. And I say that also because a lot of times people will be like, the disease, I don't have the disease, right?
I like that.
It's the fucking great way to look at it. And it also, what it also says, it being a condition rather than a disease, is that that shit can affect anybody under the right circumstances, right? Just like it affected all those Vietnam vets when they were on heroin over there and came back and were no longer on fucking heroin or whatever. I mean, it's all a condition that can happen to anybody under the right circumstances.
And to clarify for those listening, when he threw out that rather long word there, biopsychosocial, what he's talking about is what a lot of people and parents, especially fucking parents that have no fucking idea what they're talking about, that have to understand, you know, I think they threw out the difference between abuse, dependence, and addiction. And I think, what do they do? Just call it dependency now?
Yeah, it's like substance use disorder, and essentially it's better now. It's on a spectrum, which is
right. I like that part of it, but to clarify for people listening, when he says biopsychosocial, technically to classify something as a full-on addiction, it needs to affect the bio, which is your biological makeup, the psycho, obviously, which is your mind and your thinking, and your social, which are your relationships, your job, your money, your health. Not your health, that's your biology, but essentially has to affect all three of those. Your biopsychosocial are affected negatively, and therefore you could have abuse, addiction, dependency, etc.
And I also, I look at, like, you know, you look at your propensity for addiction, right? You may be working out, you're drinking your kale shakes, you know, you're feeling real good. Well, even you have that bio level that can be somewhat resistant to sort of the other level. Maybe you're fucking breaking up with your partner or whatever, and that's going like shit, but you still have good, strong bio, maybe good, strong support system. Okay. Your psychological level fell off. Well, you still have those other two. Maybe you get injured. You're all fucked up there, but you have good supports and things like that. All right. Addiction doesn't really happen. When all those things start to break down, when you start to lose those connections, psychologically, your thinking is not playing out. Your feelings are real stressed. Maybe you have mental illness. And you're getting into, like, you know, maybe there's a physiological factor as a reason why you're starting on painkillers or whatever. You're fucking better check them flags, bro, because they're probably red. And you need to, like, really look at it instead of saying, I've never been an addict or I was an addict. This is a spectrum disorder that people come in and go out of all their lives. You know, most addicts don't start at the top and spiral into oblivion. Most come in and out, and even elderly substance abuse. Oh, I was never a heavy drinker, but into, you know, all my friends are dying when I'm, you know, older, whatever. And then addiction sort of takes hold. So it is a fucking, it's less baffling than it is cunning to use the 12 step. It's pretty fucking obvious.
That was, you brought up actually two other of my issues with 12 steps is, first, the notion that, look, not everybody believes in a higher power. There's atheists and things. I actually heard a counselor in the next room to mine tell someone, well, you have to believe in something. You can make it a tree or anything.
Right.
And I went, you just told someone to believe a tree is a higher power so they could work the next steps, yeah?
Hey, man, maybe they're like an arborist or something.
Well, and so the belief in a must and a higher power in order to move forward, I didn't like. And the idea that everyone insists on introducing themselves as an addict. And my biggest issue with that, which you're probably going to go off on after I, you know, explain it, is, you know, hello, my name is Adam, and I am an addict. Yeah. Well, you don't say I am headache, do you? We don't. So we have to separate the behavior from self. We have to pull it apart by saying, hello, my name is Adam, and I'm being affected by addiction, or I'm being affected by depression. When your dialogue says, I am depression, or I am an addict, that creates pictures in your mind and then self-fulfilling prophecies, behavior.
It totally does. It totally does. And you know, you absolutely can be a person who is, fuck, if I touch a drink or if I touch a drug, I am screwed. And knowing your own, like, knowing your own self, I mean, let's face it.
Awareness, right?
Yeah. If you're knowing yourself and like, man, I'm the type of guy that when I fucking have one thing, I go, you know, well, absolutely, dude, you're fucked up and you better check that shit. But to have to insist like I'm an addict and dude, you're essentially saying that everybody in treatment needs the exact same therapy, needs the exact same thinking, needs the exact same way to crawl their ass out of there. And that is so ridiculous and not sensitive to the vast majority of people who come out of addiction and are like, well, yeah, I have a drink once in a while, or and fuck, I can just hear all the 12-steppers being like, dude, they're not a real addict. No, they're fucking addicts, dude. They're totally addicts.
They have the definition of what that addict is.
Oh,
and
man.
But if you ask them, right, they'll tell you, well, anyone can be affected by addiction, but this is the only way off.
Right. But they're not serving so many people. There are a lot of people who much more would benefit from understanding that this is a condition, that this has happened to them, that there will be certain factors that will be conducive or not conducive to relapse, that's very individualized, that some people can drink and some people can and some people can. First of all, fucking alcohol, the ultimate like relapse catalyst, personally. It's such a shitty drug anyway. It's so toxic. But yeah, so all the people who aren't receiving what they need to hear, that's also pisses me off because they're all fucking like, well, that's not really me and I guess I'm not. And dude, no, I mean, understand that everyone has their unique experience of addiction, their unique condition of addiction. And the therapy needs to be just as customized as sort of I almost said the disease itself. I almost punched myself in the nose. the condition itself. It's so used to, right? You're so used to thinking.
We've been conditioned, bro.
Dude, and you look at NIDA right now, right? The neuroscience, I did a podcast on this, how it's all about, like, it's a brain disease. Bro, there's no science for that. Talk to Carl Hart about that.
Yeah. I cannot wait till my mentor comes on this show and fucking puts to bed all this idea of brain disorder.
Yeah, and he, you know, you want to talk about a guy who must suffer in his sleep. It's got to be Dr. Hart, man, because he knows this shit better than anybody. Like, I was watching.
He's just the fucking physicians that teach the other shit.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude, you know who my idol is Stanton Peel, right? Stanton Peel was one of the first guys back in the day, you know, old guard who kind of saw through all this shit. And he was on a HuffPost Live yesterday, and he's talking about, you know, the sort of heroin epidemic and all that shit, and making like rational discussions about sort of the criminality and the harm of that, and everybody on there was like, he's crazy, nobody understands, this is, you know, the worst thing in the world. And I don't know how these guys have survived so long, dude. They survived the 80s. I mean, if you survive the 80s and you're on this side of it, like, I'm just coming up now because like everyone seems to be like a little more okay with it, but these guys, man, they deserve the real credit because they've been saying this shit for a long time. And, yeah, you know,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you said Dr. Hart's on walkabout in Malaysia. I was like, dude, now we know why. Like, he's fucking got a headache, dude.
I love the guy, man. You're right. They're right on front with it, dude.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so we're trying to support those guys in a way as well and, you know, be like the next generation coming up, man, with like fucking good knowledge and good science. And but boy, you know, you talked about the model and how it holds on and makes money and shit like that. I can just imagine, you know, you look at like the fucking disease model, like and the dogmatic sort of approach and all that shit. They must love that shit, brah. They must love someone who fucking just tells themselves that they're fucked for life. And the more fucked, well, you're more like us, the more fucked you are. Yeah, they must love it.
You're powerless. And that was the part I couldn't get, because I was also inpatient back when I was 22 years old. So I've seen the recovery from government, Medicare, and funded on both sides. I've sat in both chairs now.
Yeah.
And so 13, 14 years ago when I was in fucking inpatient and they told me the steps, well, then I go through my whole change, get out of college, ready to change the fucking world, you know, later after I changed my life. And I go, okay, let's use all this awesome new research. Nope, 12 steps is all you get to teach them. I said, 13 fucking years and I'm and now I got to teach the steps that didn't work for me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was me and IOP. First of all, I was such a dumb little shit. I thought that, I could just I'd do psycho-ed groups and everybody would magically get sober, right? I'll teach you about the biopsychosocial model and you'll be sober before you know it. And I used to think that way. But man, I remember my first program, there was this old guard 12-step guy, just a fucking hardcore 12-step asshole. But dude, he had great outcomes. Like his fucking clients were all rallied around the 12-step and getting better.
It works, dude. Look, the last bit I'm going to say about, 12 steps, I feel like I've been bashing it, but.
No, not right even, after, dude. We're being objective about it. I mean, it is what it is. It's yeah. Fucked up for some and not for others. And it is what it is, like anything else in the world.
Yeah, and you're right. And the last part of it, well, I only say it because in the beginning of the podcast, I was like, well, I'm trying not to bash it anymore. And then I just spent the last 20 minutes bashing it.
Well, dude, there's a lot to be angry about with that shit. I mean, there's a lot to be, let it flow, bro.
The issue then is the last part, I think. Maybe it's the last issue. Fuck, I don't know. Give me 10 minutes. I may have another one. But it's going, hey, you know what? You need to change your people, places, and things, but then you need to go to the same places and talk to the same people about the same things.
Yeah, well, the irony of that, and I can feel the resistance. You're obviously a resistant client, and you need to just step away from that thinking and just get to a meeting, bro. Because
that's it, right?
Call your fucking sponsor, man. You're obviously heading towards relapse even by saying that.
Right, Glenn, you have personal defects you're not admitting.
Well, and dude, honestly, I mean, again, the realities of this is, and some people, it's absolutely the case where they are who they are and with the problems they have, and that's for them, and more power to them. But dude, it's not for everybody. And the more, if we can get more options, more treatment options, more science, the better. I mean,
I'm glad you brought that up, dude, because, bash the 12 steps all you want to. It does help millions of people, but just mm-hmm. So you all know, the slogan, the reason they're able to say helping millions is because it really only helps about 1-2% of the population. If you look at the number of people in recovery, well, 1-2% is about 1 million people.
Yeah.
And so for me, when I wrote the Cognitive Rampage coming out in January, and I'm talking about chemical incarceration in this process, is exactly what you said, is I'm not for getting rid of the 12 steps because it does help millions. But like you said, and you said at the beginning of the podcast, what is missing are multiple options that are mandatory.
Yeah. Why not approach your client and see what the fuck they want to do, dude?
Most of the time you can't in these facilities, right? Because you got fucking groups of anywhere from 10. I ran groups of 26, dude.
Wow. That's a serious group, man. All you can do there is almost like, what do you do? You're doing like a psycho-ed piece and then sort of, all right, we're all going to go around. And then, raise your hand, right?
All I would do is stand up and work the whiteboard until I was sweating.
Oh, the fucking whiteboard. Gorski's relapse prevention or oh, man, I miss those guys. I really do. I love therapy and I love treatment. It's so awesome.
Well, the policy that we have now taken on, and people that have been to the Cognitive Rampage website, adamlowry.com, cognitiverampage.com, if you've been there, we've made some changes over the last 2 days, actually. And the reason I asked you about your policies that you're taking on is because we have chosen to take on a policy, and after January, we are actually taking probably a 2-3 week road trip up to DC and then headed to New York, and we want to change mandated policy for interventions that are supposed to be mandated at government funded dual diagnosis facilities. So what we're trying to do out here is get CBT as an offered course like Smart Recovery as mandated as much as the 12 steps. And I want EMDR in every government-funded dual diagnosis facility because you and I both know that trauma is at the base of much, much, much of the drug abuse or drug addiction. And so why can't we have EMDR and CBT both with better records than the 12 steps? Guaranteed, mandated as an option for those in therapy.
Yeah. Again, I'm not a big model guy, but first of all, I mean, I love the idea of offering options, man. I love the idea of offering options. If somebody looks at EMDR and you're presenting them with this, I would love to have, and I see this in some treatment programs, right? They're, even everything from massage and yoga or whatever, hopefully that's sustainable when they get out. But offering up different models of recovery, which one, engaging with your client, be like, what do you think is going to work best for you here? Well, here's these two models. You can do Smart Recovery, right? Which is sort of less dog, you know, less, you know, sort of, I would say spiritually based
or dogma.
Yeah. I mean, less, you know, less dogmatic or whatever and about more relapse prevention. Or do you feel like, you know, really getting back to maybe, you know, some, this resonates with you, the 12 step, you know, it's obviously more popular than this other thing. What's going to work for you? And let's try that. Let me support you and what you think. Oh, you're a fucking addict. I can't listen to you. You don't know what you're talking about. Right. And that's the way we treat them usually.
Right. Shut up and sit down in group. Follow these 10 rules. Don't speak unless spoken to. Raise your fucking hand.
Right.
What the fuck, dude?
And then the treatment providers. I mean, fuck. I mean, just sitting around and be like, oh, he's a fucking resistance or. Yeah, well, we treat these people like shit generally, huh?
we really fucking do, man.
Well, let me say this about your EMDR thing. So, dude, trauma-informed care. Right. So that's a big, big new approach going through all the social service agencies, goes through my agency, all this stuff. And it's really about sensitivities around trauma and the effect of trauma and all that. And that's really, so you're looking at EMDR for trauma, but at the very least, like the awareness. And then if you start looking actually at sort of the approaches of these programs and that and treating clients like that, dude, it's fucking traumatizing, bro. You isolate someone in a treatment center or they're the bad ones and they're the fuck up and whatever and they have to be in that. What do you think that does to somebody, man? You know, I mean, they got enough pain. You're going to roll that shit up on them. Come on.
Dude, I 100% agree. And I'm also glad you're kind of talking about the practitioner end of it too, because I'm going to kind of make a left off of the 12 steps here and still stick with the process, because what you run into also at these government funded facilities is a 21-year-old, 6-month graduate who has no license, who has probably never even experienced addiction in her life or his life, sitting in a group of anywhere, like I said, from 8 to 22 hardcore long-term addict prison people. And then has to somehow command this group by just passing out a fucking worksheet like they do every morning. And they pass it around and they try to go over it and wonder why they get ripped to shreds.
Yeah.
And so the, like you talked about, is the actual treatment that's provided is done by this, and they can do that. And so you're licensed, right? You're a licensed mental health counselor.
Yeah, I am.
And how long have you been licensed?
I've been like, oh, recently, man. I actually just took a course that I had to finish up for developmental psych, and I got my license about a year ago.
See, it's perfect because I have a big fucking issue with how, well, really, the licensure people are eating their own. But that stems from A, therapy is diving because private therapy doesn't, you know, who's got $150 or $250 a week to spend to see somebody weekly? So private practices are closing down. That's why you see these gigantic influxes of community mental health places.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally owned by someone that gave up their license because they saw the government was handed out millions of fucking dollars for opening up these places. And then so what happens is somebody wants to help. They want to be a counselor, psychologist, even licensed clinical social worker. They go to school, do their thing. They come out majorly fucking in debt. And then you're trying to get a job. A, you can't get a job anywhere without a fucking license. And it's not going to happen. Or they will hire you, but will pay you shit fucking money to work here. That's why you wind up with a 21-year-old making $17.50 an hour who has no idea what they're doing. And then you wind up with licensed people that can't run a private practice, or they're getting paid $17.50 an hour working as a therapist. And then what do? If you want to get licensed after your master's degree, you got to find somebody with a license. And many times I've seen licensed people, brother, charging these college graduates anywhere from $25 to $250 a fucking hour for, 1,500 hours?
Well, I tell you what you do. You put 23 people in their group and you fucking make that money, bro.
Well, that's what they've done, right, in order to do it. So all these sides, you know, the therapists are forced to hold down jobs that are shit, work in environments that are shit. The people, a.k.a. as addicts, have awful help offered to them. It's like you said, there's no real options. And it's a fuckery, as Joe would say.
And people keep dying. You know, again, even addiction, man. I mean, the biggest harms in all this, like addiction, you know, you look at that heroin maintenance program in the Netherlands and in Switzerland. Dude, they have no fucking overdoses there, dude. Zero. Yeah.
I'm glad you went back there, dude. I have a question for you, actually.
Yeah, sure. Well, real quick, what I was going to say is, dude, addiction, I can fucking treat addiction, brah. You give me someone with addiction, I'll rock that shit. I'll fucking help a lot of people. I'm not bad at what I do. But, man, you wrap that shit into the drug war. You get those charges flowing. They can't get a fucking good job. Their family alienates them. You know, stigma sets in. They're fucked up. They're traumatized. They go back to more drugs. Bro, you greatly complicate my efforts and fucking kill that patient, man, through that drug war. Addiction, dude. If there's one thing, I'll tell you one thing for people out there. Fucking don't stop tripping on addiction, man. Relax on the fucking addiction, dude. Addiction, the condition, okay? Like any other condition, it's so fatal. Bro, you know what? It's fatal mostly because if you're fucking putting some spike in your arm of horse shit and hand grenades or fucking gunpowder or whatever, right? I mean, all that stuff. That's what's fucking killing people, man. You look at these other programs all around the world where you're stabilizing on opiates and shit like that and get that engagement, fuck, then bring them into treatment, then bring them into healthcare, then bring them into dental care, then set them up with a job, then get them into housing. And, all of a sudden, a fucking addiction sort of secondary to how great life is going if you can stabilize them on that. So just chill on the addiction, except don't chill here, bro, because that shit is fatal in the United States. We've made that shit the greatest killer. I mean, look at that. More than fucking car accidents, man. That was another thing that sort of put me over the edge is how many people die from fucking OD now, man. Ugh.
And it's the number one reason for incarceration.
Even that. I mean, shit. It's like that was one thing that bummed me out on the policy thing. It's like I'm going up when I do the DC thing, and I by the way, I don't always talk like this, so you know, I can just assume talk very differently and professionally and all that. But that's all you.
Give us the Washington professional pitch.
The Washington professional voice. I start laughing, but the Washington professional voice. I would be looking at I don't even think I could fake it with you, dude. I'm just having too much fun. I don't think I could do it. But if I'm standing in front of my representatives, I can do good, right? So do well. There you go. What the hell was I saying? So on the policy front, I mean, it's all about these, you know, marijuana policies, and we're moving forward with that and schedule moving it to Schedule 2 and all this stuff. But, dude, there's nothing that's like, I mean, I guess that's sort of life-saving. If you look at that as like how they're using cannabis as like maintenance therapy and things like that. But there is nothing on there for like any kind of like opiate maintenance or expanding methadone or all these treatments that can really be fucking helpful. Again, even if you're not into they're still on a drug or whatever like that. Dude, save their lives and let me hear your fucking issues later. Because man, you get some guy who's on, you know, pills and then they jump off that shit and they're on heroin and they're drinking and they're on benzos and blah, 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 in the fucking legal market. I mean, that's where death is, bro. So anyway, yeah.
I mean, the policy part is real, man. Like I mentioned in the podcast, everybody definitely needs to watch The House I Live In. And yep. If you are second guessing Mr. Glenn Marshall here, the Addictus podcast host himself, about what he's talking about, maintenance clinics and the idea of not necessarily maintenance clinics, but helping people use cleaner and then slowly moving them into the process of recovery. Just look up the facts and research on the very first place, Portugal, that did it, and look up other countries that have followed. The crime rates go down, hepatitis C goes down, AIDS goes down, everything goes down, deaths by OD go down, and eventually those that recover, those numbers go up.
Well, Portugal decriminalized, but it's actually, so for actual heroin maintenance, you only see that, they had it in Vancouver, Canada, I believe. They definitely have it in Switzerland, full on, and the Netherlands. Portugal, no, you still got to buy your shitty drugs off some scumbag dealer and fucking shoot that shit in. But yeah, the idea of maintenance. So you know what they see? Again, Google, the best thing I Google was, you'll love this combo, Danish poppy heroin coffee, I think is the magic. And at the top of that, there'll be a link to thefilm.com, and there'll even be a little preview. And what you see there is a normal little center. First of all, the fact you have to like gather all the folks together is never ideal. Ideally, they're getting it from a pharmacy or whatever. I mean, the more normal we can make fucking addiction, the better, right? But they receive their dose up to 3 times a day of opiates. You know what it becomes, dude? Just like Johann Hari says in his book, boring. Fucking addiction gets so boring, right? Just like the methadone guys who are totally, you know, functional, whatever. They get their stuff. They go to work. They have a family. They do their life. And even heroin maintenance, after like 3 years, 2-3 years, they're like, this fucking is boring. I don't want to have to keep coming down here. Let me transition on to methadone. So it takes all the wonderful excitement out of addiction. You know, a big part of addiction is these massive swings to jonesing and craving and wanting and seeking, and then up and you're all high and you're fucking duh, and then you're back down. And a big part of it is those oscillations, you know? And so when you see these clinics and you're like, oh my God, heroin maintenance, dude, no OD, no AIDS, no Hep B, everybody bored, fucking bores the shit out of them. I mean, it's not even exciting anymore. And you see that like with different drugs, like when you sort of normalize things out like that. So check that out. Again, that's, you know, we need a spectrum of care, right? We need an entire spectrum for any single person that walks in the door. I need to be able to serve them right where they're at and then take them from that position to wherever they're going. That's going to make their life better and improve things. Dude, abstinence is should be the least of my fucking concerns. I want to save their life. I mean, dude, if somebody's out there fucking prostituting themselves to afford coke, I mean, holy shit, dude. You know, I mean, you know what the fuck happened to those people, right? I mean, health-wise and I mean, psychologically and not the fucking danger they're in. I mean, and get the harms out of there.
I can hear some. I do have some hardcore right-wing fans, and I can hear them now going, and it's kind of sad now that I'm thinking about it, right? Because I'm hearing you talk, and, you know, I at first wasn't a giant fan of methadone maintenance clinics of any kind, because down in Florida, a ton of them are abused, and they way over, you know, play their role. Yeah. And so I have issues with that, and I'd like to focus more on having, not necessarily quitting or abstinence, but, you know, Dr. Andrew Hill talks about teaching tolerance and maintenance, and it's a way to start, but I'm with you, though, kind of to a point to where at least they're not dying in an alley, and, yes. You know, I mentioned Portugal and the decriminalization of Portugal, but what they have done is they have stopped in jailing people for drugs, yes. And have taken all that money and offered what you just said, which is a wide variety of free, large spectrum help.
Yeah, dude, I'm not, by the way, right-wing fans, I'm not the fucking inventor of this. Like, I didn't, like, you know, Glenn Marshall came up with fucking heroin maintenance. No, dude, the only reason I found out about
the first one in Hawaii, bro.
Oh, yeah, well, shit. I mean, but dude, so when I come to D.C., right, I'm officially going to be moving up here. It looks like June. But yeah, I mean, you know, watch the video, right? Look at the video, look at the research, watch how normal it looks. Like, people receive their dose in a controlled setting with a nurse. The drugs are completely sterile. Thank God. I mean, dude, if only you guys knew what goes in a fucking heroin, it is not any kind of thing you would want to even put on your skin rather than like shoot in your veins, right? But you see this. It's seeing is believing. And if you see even the preview of what this looks like, and again, it's still in that clinic setting, which isn't ideal. Ideally, by the way, if you ever want to look back to what normal looks like, go back to, you know, 1910, right? Go back before the drug war and go look at your heroin and cocaine, lozenges for your bronchitis or your, you know, or just walking into a pharmacy and get, you know, dude, in Britain, you know, addiction wasn't even like considered like a big fucking deal there before the Harrison Act. It came through the U.S. and they did their own thing in like 1920 or whatever. All these issues of addiction that we are so freaked out about are directly correlated with the war against drugs. Straight up. That's it. Yes, dude, you look at methamphetamine, that shit is sold by prescription. It's called Desoxin. You can look that fucking thing up. You'll hear Dr. Carl Hart talk about these things that they're not the demons that they have been made out to be. They're just chemicals. Some people struggle with them. You can engage those people. You can help those people. But yeah, it's all like, it's all a lot of like bullshit we've been taught. So, but if you look at and again, you know, seeing is believing, right? So you look at pictures, right? You know, the pictures of these, you know, codeine, you know, or heroin syrup or coca wine and all these normal things that were before the Harrison Act. All we're doing is rolling back to baseline, dude. We are not fucking progressive here. We are crawling out of the pit. That is the drug war. We're just trying to get back to baseline, back to normal drugs. For me, my perfect model is get that shit in the pharmacy. We have doctors. If an addiction starts to form, dude, engage that person. Look at the issues around there, whatever kind of support they need. I know they're not going to fucking die. Most people don't die when they're maintaining themselves on clean, regulated opiates, just like they don't die in Switzerland, just like they don't die, you know, in the Netherlands and all that shit. And again, you see the video, you see the, you know, the pictures of these types of things pre-1914, pre-Harrison Act. And it's a whole nother world before fucking Anslinger, before, you know, before, you know, global domination, before all that shit, before we supplanted Germany and Japan as the world's greatest pharmacy and said, these drugs you can do and these drugs you can't do. And if you do these, you're fucked. And if you do these, you're fine. And it's just ridiculous.
And all of that is based on shape to hell of a fucking cognitive rampage, by the way, Glenn.
Fuck, brah. Yeah, dude, it's driving me, brah. Make no mistake. That's exactly what is driving all of this. Got to make change. We got to try. I mean, what else can we do? I could sit there and go beach every day, brah. You come over my place. We go beach, fucking chill. You know, it's all good hanging out, but not anymore. Not anymore. I've been doing that for 20 years and just doing my thing and knowing these things. And I've always, you know, sort of spoken out a little bit here and there to my, you know, my friends or whatever. But now I got a big mouth. I don't fucking bring that shit to DC and spread my verbal diarrhea around there. So.
You have to, man. And sometimes I do sit back and I mean, we both understand the idea of a cognitive dissonance, but I do sit back and go, how the fuck can people just sit silently, especially if they have children? Because one day they're going to have to pass this fucked up, broken, corrupt world to their kid. And they're going to have to fucking say, hey, I'm sorry I didn't do shit, but clock in and clock out and push you to some corrupt idea of this system.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the truth. I mean, if you know it, that's a tipping point, right? Like if you're out there and you're like, this is bullshit, I hate this, you know, 12, like if you're in that mode, you get a pass. Like you really do. I understand that for 100 years you have seen this taking place exactly how it is. And, you know, you were born, you know, even if you're older, right? And you grew up in the 70s and 80s and you saw the, you know, drug war and the oppression and you're like, lock those fuckers up. I get that. But if they were
the number one targeted, right? With the whole fucking propaganda bullshit.
Yeah. But if you know, if you're out there and you're like Adam and I, and you know this shit and you're seeing it, that's when you know, now is the time, it's normalized enough, at least the discussion, right? I can have this discussion and, at least I don't think I'll get fired. I mean, I sort of fucking hope so, but dude, it was worth it to me. I mean, honestly, but it's worth it to me to try. Dude, 42, what the fuck? I mean, I'm not getting any younger, right? I mean, it's worth it to me now to try. It's worth it to try to help somebody. It's worth it to put the right information out there. And, I mean, you see what happened with weed, right? I mean, a lot of people sort of, not even a lot, like little pockets in Washington, little pockets in Colorado got together and they're like, we're going to fucking try this. And it worked. And screw weed. I mean, if you're in weed, well, whatever. But dude, that also means that people aren't getting fucking records, that they're not getting arrested, that the cops aren't targeting people for weed. Dude, cops used to be great. I mean, there used to be community policing and good interaction. We fucking militarized those guys. We put a drug war in there. We fucking gave those gangsters money and guns and all their bullshit, made those drugs dirty, made addicts sick, and alienated our police. Dude, by the way, check out Law Enforcement Against Prohibition on my podcast, The Addictive Podcast. Dude, you'll hear Rafer Davis. He's another one you should have on here, man. He's all into the idea of police harming themselves through violence. Like it's an amazing position, dude, in terms of trauma and actually protecting. He's a cop, right? I mean, protecting cops and how the drug war like sort of pushes this immoral behavior by our by police.
It makes the citizens the enemy. So yes. That's how they're trained and treated.
Yes, and the fucking police are not meant to do that, dude. Why are you having a police officer who is meant to fight crime deal with addiction?
Right.
These things have no god darn relationship to each other, right? But we are so used to 100 years conditioned. It's cool. I get my mom listening to the podcast. She's starting to fucking change too, right? I mean, but again, I mean, people. Well, yeah.
You speak to a strong point. I was talking to my brother too. You know, those that were in the you're from the same era as him and myself. And
he's a Coconut Grove guy, sort of South Miami.
No, he's an Orlando guy, but you know, he's 8 years
hardcore
old.
Up there.
And so right in that area,
you guys get no ocean, bro. I make you crazy.
It does, brother. I promise you that.
Gee, too hot up there, bro. I've been to Disney World. That shit's like flat and hot. I like the Glacier, man. I like my gators. I like canoeing on the Peace River and shit like that. I'm all down with that.
Yeah, it's too much tourist, really. But, you know, our generation and just before theirs even were raised heavily, heavily, heavily and beaten psychologically with this craziness of propaganda of government influence that these things are demons. And, you know, you talked about a picture of people and how, you know, if, you know, you're right, most of them don't know, you know, but if you're aware really of what it is, most people have such a strong concrete belief about what it is and an image. And, you know, I can hear people also, though, yelling at us both at the other end of this podcast going, how dare you say heroin isn't a demon? How dare you say meth isn't bad, et cetera, et cetera? And are blowing up because either they've lost a friend or they're someone they love is experiencing it. And so this plays into a heavy bias in shows like Intervention, which I can't, they kill us because they make it seem like they're demons. So, and so people soak this up and they believe all this stuff. And partly it's only half their fault because they've been, you know, bamboozled and lied to. And so, you know, for those of you that are experiencing somebody or yourself or know somebody or lost somebody to this addiction, by no means are we trying to walk out of the seriousness.
It's horrible. Make no mistake. It's bad enough as it is. You don't need, they didn't even make it worse.
Yeah, exactly right. And so, you know, a sincere for what you have felt and experiencing now, if you're in it or somebody else that's in it, you know, but awareness is what it's about. And so when we really realize the reason, I think maybe you can, I'll try to talk to you for you for a second, Glenn, but maybe what we're really trying to point out is stop demonizing the person, stop blaming the drugs, and look at the system, look at the life we offer, look at the trauma we've been through, and look at how much better help we can now offer. And that's, I think, what I'm trying to point out too.
Yes, I think that's a great point. And again, you know, they may feel this way now, but if they see the video of heroin maintenance, if they look at sort of the normalization of these things, if they look at how it's handled in other countries where there is no goddamn overdosing, dude, imagine that world. That world exists. It's just right across the fucking pond. You can look at it, and it works over there. Dude, we're, you know, like I said, addiction is brutal. Addiction can be terrible, but it's made so much worse by the fact that every time someone puts a spike in their arm, that they are so much closer to, like, you know, dude, the effective dose to lethal dose of heroin is like 1 to 3, right? Alcohol is like 1 to 20. You take one ounce of alcohol, effective dose, take 20 shots, you fucking die on that shit, right? Weed is like 1 to 40,000, you know, cocaine is some other number. Yeah. Heroin is 1 to 3. Oh, wait, real quick.
Sorry, go ahead. 34 Tylenol kills you.
Yeah. So, I mean, dude, imagine. So when you talk about opiates, man, or heroin, you know, you're talking about a drug where one drug dealer doesn't cut it. Right. And cut it. We talk about adulterants. Right. And you can imagine the ingredients they put in there. But just one guy decides to undercut the market and put some pure shit out there. And all of a sudden, you, the same person that injected the same dose, they're like, I know what works for me. I don't fucking die on this. Bruh. Well, guess what? Now they're fucking dead, too, because they just injected a stronger concentration of the drug. You know, the potency's there and you're fucking dead, right? Or they're taking benzos and there's no information about, like, you know, safe management of benzos. And my God, dude, there was one of these things on the Drug Policy Alliance thing for, you know, just spreading, you know, naloxone and naltrexone and shit like that, which all that does is prevent overdose. The fact we have to have a fucking bill to, like, try to spread the antidote for the death, and, like, we have to fucking pitch that, dude. We have to, like, push just to try to save lives. What kind of bullshit is that? I mean, you can't even get, it'd be like fucking restricting Band-Aids, dude. You know, I mean, it makes no sense at all. So the whole thing is so weighed against looking at these things demonically and like it's the evil and all that. And it is the demonic and it is the evil, but it's caused a lot by, dude, Rafer Davis, the cop, said this great thing. He's like, dude, prohibition is not the epitome of regulation. It's not the epitome of control. It's not the ultimate control. It's actually the absence of any kind of control, of any kind of regulation. You're taking your hands off of these substances, which are deadly, certain ones under the right circumstances, and you're saying, go run with that shit, drug dealer, black market, you know, rock that shit. I mean, that's what we've done, dude. We haven't made it any fucking safer. We've removed any kind of sensible controls. We've removed our experts. We've removed our doctors. We've removed our pharmacists. We've removed our fucking psychopharmacologists. All of these people, we have removed them and just said, well, you know, illegal market, you know, rock and roll. You guys are going to go make billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars off our citizens.
Off of sick people.
Off of fucking the sickest people, dude. That's what's so crazy, right? Off of the sickest people, the people who need our help the most. And we've done this to them, bro. We've allowed this to happen. I'll tell you, Adam, it'll go down as the greatest harm of fucking policy ever. No question.
Dude, I love chatting with you, dog. We got to do this a lot more often, actually.
Oh, well, I'll get you on. I mean, I want to hear about all this crazy. Dude, now that you're.
Let me know.
Well, now you're a full-time podcaster. Because I don't know anything about, like, I can't even picture. I picture sort of like, when I think of you, I picture like a big building, and I picture like, you know, it's sort of a hospital setting, and like, I don't know what it was like or what you saw. I mean, the only times I did residential, it was like sort of like a house, you know, that had been like donated.
Chris Bell said it best on Joe Rogan and my podcast, that it's something out of One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Wow.
And brother, I mean, from when I was inpatient myself to working in them, it really does, man. It's people walking around in gowns and clothes they borrowed. And I mean, unfortunately, when I say dual diagnosis to people, that means these are people that suffer from addiction as well as some serious mental disorder.
Oh, yeah. Vulnerable, even more vulnerable than just addiction, even more complicated, more vulnerable, more resilient to sort of conventional models of treatment. And we're just like, you're fuck. Oh, God, dude, it just drives me nuts. I feel you, man. Got to go get on that. Got to go work out. I mean, it does, dude. It really is affecting. It's right between crime and crying and passion, dude, is kind of where I live in this when I talk about this shit. So anyway,
I happen to agree with you, man. That's why a lot of my fuck bombs start coming out when I start talking about it. I had multiple friends disappear for a decade, decade and a half, 2 decades. You know, and are still locked up in some concrete little box somewhere, brother.
And I
was threatened with that same little box. And when I watched that documentary I keep referring to, The House I Live In, I couldn't imagine this one guy. He got caught with 3 ounces of methamphetamine for trafficking, and he's doing life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think about my friends, you know, my buddies that have done a lot of time, and somewhere out there, there's a wife, a daughter, a son who's missing their dad or their mom, and they've been locked up on some bullshit, trumped up mandatory minimum charges. They're doing 20 to 30 fucking years for bullshit. And brother, that's when you hear me now, brother. That's when I start getting fucking angry.
Yeah, and you think that's bad? Just wait till they get out, man. Wait till they get out with that record. Wait till they get out, and life has passed them by. And
we have the highest recidivism rate in the world.
Yeah, I and family has passed them by, and they're given nothing, and they step out that door, and they have fucking nothing, and they're like, good luck, you know.
Go to a meeting.
Go to a fucking, well, dude, geez, I'd go. I'll fucking go 12-step. I mean, what else you got?
That's it. I know, and that's what we fucking offer them, dude. I know you have nothing. You have a shit life. No one loved you. No one cared for you. Hell, you're so messed up.
Your family's embarrassed of you, dude. We're ashamed of you. Look at what you did to yourself. Look at what you did to your family. Look at how you abandoned your kids. Well, it could have been a fucking little, temporary sort of condition. All sorts of reasons, man. People are fucking crazy when they're young, number one, especially, right? Dumbass decisions. I know I was. And now all of a sudden we've put that in. We've criminalized them. We've given them good criminal training, by the way, because that's what you learn in fucking prison. And now we're like, and now we just send them out, and we're just like, go. By the way, plenty of drugs in prison too, right? And all that shit.
And that tells you it's a set up system, because, I mean, how are you supposed to get out with a felony on your fucking thing and get a job? You're going the fuck back, because they want you to get back until they drain you of all your money, all your resources, rip your entire biopsychosocial from you, then they lock you in a box for fucking life.
And they're going to make you work in there, man. You're going to be working. You're going to be making furniture. You're going to be making desks. You're going to be taking fucking teleconference calls. You're going to be making your 20 cents an hour, whatever the fuck they pay.
They make slaves from sick people.
That's it. That's it, dude. If it ain't the drug that made you a slave, well, now the system's going to make you a slave. And in any case, we're going to draw that fucking money out. And somebody's going to be making it, whether it's the prison industrial complex or the fucking bail bonds union or any of these other guys that are down with this system that come into these meetings and are like, we don't think we should decriminalize marijuana or whatever. But I don't give a shit about marijuana, but I sure as hell give a shit about what that does to a person if they get fucking busted with it. And I sure as hell give a shit about the addiction issue too. You know, man, I would really want to focus on addiction and dealing with people, like people, and not have their family like freak out and just all of it. And we have made it. We have traumatized addicts. We have sucked their fucking monies dry. We have sucked their families' monies dry. We've sucked the insurance company's money dry. Dude, just like our favorite family who's up there on the Forbes, you know, number 14, the Purdue Pharma family in the fucking billionaire list. By the way, I would much rather have had OxyContin than the giant cutoff. I did another podcast on this too, than the big fucking cutoff, which pushes everybody onto illegal heroin, and then you have all the problems that come with that.
Probably set up that way.
You know, dude, I tell you what, I tell you this, if it's by accident, you couldn't have fucking planned it better, could you have? I mean, you really couldn't. You couldn't have, if it was by accident, you are the luckiest son of a bitch in the world. Either if you're a fucking cartel guy or you're a pharma guy or you're a prison guy, you really couldn't do it better. Hats off to you. I commend you for being such a fucking evil genius.
And dude, it's why I correct people when they say a broken system. And I tell you, no. It is running exactly how it was designed.
Dude. I don't like to believe that, but again, you read that Susanna Reese book. I forget the main title. I just always remember The Alchemy of U.S. Empire. I forget the main part of that. But you read that book and you or listen to that book on Audible, and you hear about how we went down to South America, how we sort of interjected drug policy down there, how we told these countries, you know, Ecuador, Peru, yeah, well, you know, we're going to fuck the Altiplano Indians. We're going to be doing social reengineering on them. We got to get them down in the valleys. They got to be working. By the way, countries, you guys are never going to make your own. Of course, America, right? The largest importer of coca still, the largest manufacturer of cocaine, right? The largest user of coca. I mean, Coca-Cola still use that fucking product, and then they extract it, and then they sell the cocaine, by the way, which also goes to like wonderful undercover drug deals, for the DEA and shit. It's also, you know, still can be used medicinally or whatever. But you listen to that book and you listen to her research and what, and that's when you start talking like this, that's where I'm like, shit, that shit could be true. Because I always thought it was, you know, the model was always the prejudice model. Okay, well, we don't like the blacks, you know, and the fucking jazz. Well, fuck heroin. And then we don't like the blacks again in the 80s, the fuck crack. Let's face it, the blacks are really fucking getting really fucked, brah. Yep. You know, or the hippies in the 60s, and we're banned LSD and all that. And now
that they've exposed every fucking minority through the process we talked about, which is ostracized, point out.
Yeah.
Right now,
marijuana was marijuana was Mexican in the fucking, you know, Mexican immigration back in the early 20s or whatever. And they're bringing across their local weed and all that stuff. But when you read this book, man, and you see how we kind of went down to South America and did some of these things, this sort of reengineering project. And then we told those countries, by the way, we strong armed them. They are like, you guys can never manufacture pharmaceutical drugs. And that was all fucking down with like Merck Pharmaceuticals, like how we were like in, you know, oh, we want our industries to thrive. So we're going to repress coca. Yet we're still going to be like importing coca. We made it where, dude, they couldn't even manufacture their own pharmaceutical industry. Right. We said you guys are only good in South America for raw fucking materials. That's all we need from you. You're never going to be a manufacturer. We're going to make United Nations drug policy say that. And we're happy to import your wholesale leaves. But in terms of manufacturing and any real like power or getting ahead as a society, well, you guys are a bunch of fucking farmers. Fuck you. And that was the model down there. And Susanna Reese outlines that so clearly. And you're, dude, so when you talk conspiracy theory, I think to that book and I'm like, well, we fucking seem to have done it everywhere else in the world, you know? So why not to our own?
It is, man. And most people, they just have that cognitive dissonance to it, man. And look, after a while, the system that I believe is perfectly built to ingest the bottom 10 and 15% of poor people once they've liquidated them, eventually will become non-discretionary to race. It eventually, and it's already getting there because whites are now beginning to catch up. And
yeah, right. Meth
is taking over trailer parks, mountains, and white ghettos. I mean, it's now eating everyone alive.
You know why that is? In Hawaii, we're totally seeing that. And you know why that is? So on a lot of the I was listening to my former executive director.
Sorry, brother. I have to also say, but not yet. Whites are not being killed nearly as much as African or Black Americans.
Oh, yeah,
that's
dude.
Disparagingly different. So
oh, no. Well, when it happens to whites, that makes everybody care a little bit. That's all. just get a little, they're still scumbags, but you know, we're going to care a little bit. By the way, that book again, I just pulled it up on my phone. It's called We Sell Drugs, The Alchemy of U.S. Empire.
Okay.
We Sell Drugs by Susanna Reese. Listen to that, and then all your conspiratorial, theories will get pretty much validated in terms of U.S. imperialism. And
I mean, I don't know. You know, I can't sit here and say definitely so. But it just, I mean, when it smells like fucking shit and it looks like fucking shit.
Dude, it is the money. I mean, you do follow. But again, if this was all accidental and I, you know, maybe people are just afraid of addiction and they thought like, okay, well, this is a good idea. And then but again, right? Things take on a life of their own. Sometimes a system will start and then all of a sudden the money's flowing and then people are feeding everybody off that money, right? And it becomes so even like a dysfunctional or unhealthy system, man, if the money is there. By the way, you should also know that, like, some of the biggest pressures against making drugs illegal, like, do come out of the fucking cartels. I was going to tell you this about meth. So that's the new move, right, by the cartels. They're now trying to undercut the heroin market. So we see a lot of guys who are, you know, hooked on opiates and heroin that they're fucking sliding cheap meth in there and sort of bringing them over onto methamphetamine. So if you guys are seeing that, it's funny. Are you actually seeing that in Florida now, the methamphetamine thing kind of, or is that more West Coast or?
No, it is fucking rampant, brother.
No shit. Well, about time you fuckers kind of got that bullshit too, because that was real. I mean, Hawaii was rolling with that shit when I got over there 20 years ago, and it sort of was pocketed out. But now the cartels are making a very deliberate. And by the way, that's another consequence of the war on drugs and fucking criminalizing marijuana, is that you run people on a harder shit. Why? Because you run people on a harder shit because you want the best bang for the buck and make that money. And if you have a small product that you can charge more money for, that's easier to manufacture, well, that's basic fucking marketing, right?
Yeah.
So dude, I wouldn't even speak about it. My name, they'll probably kill me, but
yeah,
don't kill me, cartels. Please don't kill me. But you guys gotta understand, it's about helping people, cartels. Please.
Yeah, I get a death threat a week, brother. So yeah.
Are you fucking kidding? You're joking.
No.
Are you serious?
I do. Yeah, I do, man.
Oh my God, dude, that's crazy.
I'm terrified. After Joe Rogan, brother, I had multiple death threats.
Oh my God, dude, what? How is this possible? What are you doing? You're just talking about like healthy, being healthy?
Because of my one comment, because I said Suboxone is like heroin when I was trying to, people missed the context, but because of saying that.
Oh, so people freaked out on that?
Dude, if you look, it's fucked up, man. I don't want to put this shit out there, but people out of my whole fucking time on there, they pick out the one dumb thing that I said based on being fucking nervous. You know what I mean?
Oh, but yeah.
So be careful. And I'll tell you two things. You talked about when you were starting your podcast about being fired or whatever. Both of the places that I was doing therapy at fired me before I even got back from L.A.
Yeah. Well, Hawaii's a little more sensitive. I mean, what am I, you know, the only shit I've said, I mean, I've kind of looked at that. I mean, I'm not pro drugs. I mean, I'm just fucking trying. I'm really about like pro life. Wait, but not that kind of pro life. You just can't goddamn win, Adam, man. Anywhere I turn, we're fucked. So that's all there is to it. So, I mean, might as well go out on your fucking shield, bro, right?
Hey, fucking damn right. And that's what I tell people to do, man, is, you know, if you're standing there and somebody's going to attack your family or kill them, would you, and then, mind you, they're trained, they're big, they're huge. Would you just step aside and say, have at them? You fucking wouldn't. You'd swing until there wasn't no more. And it may not be your family yet out there, and it may not be your loved one yet, but it's coming. And it's fucking coming, and I hope you're willing to step up and fight, man. Like you are, Glenn. I appreciate you stepping up, jumping out there like a bad motherfucking cognitive rampage dude, risking this shit, because people don't understand, man. You are really, really risking everything you went to school for, licenses, and everything.
That's it. I mean, even from back in the day in college, man, talking about that Stanton-Peel model, you know, I talked about, oh, here's the 12-step disease model. I'm just was reading the list, and even the fucking professor's like, sit down now. That's ridiculous. You know, any kind of information like that, they shut me right down in school with even thinking that. And I'm like, oh my God, wow. Okay. I guess I'm wrong. All right. That's fine. You know, disease model it is. I'll go with that. And I've been a big neuro guy and all that, and like, you know, science based and all that stuff. But, you know, looking at it more and again, especially in other countries and listening to like, Carl Hart, the leading neuroscientist in the field. A lot of this is bullshit. So, don't be duped out there, man. Do your own fucking homework. Well, just check out some of the things we've talked about today, and you may start to see things a little bit differently.
Yeah, man. And last question, brother, I'll take you out before, what, given everything you've seen, what you're doing, what's your present life philosophy?
My present life philosophy? Okay. My present life philosophy is... Okay, actually, dude, you know what it is? I'm going to put it in my bar apartment, actually. I met this other guy, and he's not into this. He's just doing his own thing. But, dude, we follow dreams is what I was going to put in my stairwell. I was going to post that right up there. And I'll tell you this. If you are into your passion, like I'm passionate about this, right? And that's why I wanted to get back to it, because I've always felt passionate about it. And the ability to drive yourself based on passion and based on something outside of yourself or doing something beyond yourself, like I said in the beginning, like lifting up others around you or helping people. If you are where you need to be, my fuck up school used to call it your unique potential. That's actually what they would call it. It was based on like, Scott Peck's book or one of these guys. And that was all about like really finding your place in the world. So I would just say, that whatever you're doing, and dude, I don't make any money off of this. You'll also notice that I don't have any advertisements. I'm not even looking. I could give a shit. I could care fucking less. But if it can be about like making like the world a better place, and I can be in my passion, the only time I ever feel this good is when somebody's getting better. When a client is improving, it's the only other time I've ever felt like this. So follow your fucking passions, dude. Right out there. Take your first step. Again, I'm going to live in a barn so I can sort of afford. I'm not even shitting you, right? I'm sort of setting up my life. Dude, my wife ain't keen on that either, right? But I'm trying to set up my life where I can follow my passions, take greater risks. Use my sort of experience and credentials and sort of leverage that. And my God, if like even with the cannabis craving thing, even if a few people have some benefit on that, I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be happier than I feel kind of doing what I'm doing because it's my passion. And that's got to be it. And there have been times where I haven't done that, but oh man, it feels so good to do that. So that would be my life philosophy.
I love it, brother. Give everybody one more time where they can find you on Twitter, et cetera.
Yeah, well, dude, I've been living on Twitter. I'm not like, dude, by the way, as a therapist, I've like hidden my whole life. Like, I never put my shit on social media, right? Fucking clients and shit like that. But, dude, you can find me on Addictist on Twitter, Addictist. You can go to the podcast page which is the website, which is theaddictivepodcast.com. And again, I would also encourage if anybody is out there, we're looking for guests, or if you can move things forward, if you can be a part of this, I am happy to put you on there and put it out there and let's raise everybody up together. That would be it.
Oh, dude, I love it, man. Thanks for chatting with me today, dude. We're gonna do this more often, man. We're gonna do this more.
Dude, you know what, Adam? Number one, it means a lot to me, and number two, fucking next time we do this, I'm hoping to be living over here, and I will come down to Orlando, and we'll fucking sit in that cave.
Yeah, man.
We will chill the fuck out, and we will talk all about fishing and canoeing and fucking swimming and all those fun shit we also like to do. So I look forward to seeing you in person as well, man.
Dude, for sure, man. And anytime on the Addictive Podcast, brother, I'll come on anytime you need, man.
Right on. Well, we're going to talk all that crazy treatment shit, so I look forward to hearing it, and I'll talk to you soon, man.
Hey, you're the best, man. I appreciate it. Take care of you the rest of the weekend, man, and I'll talk with you again soon.
Yeah, you too. Time to rock DC. I'll talk to you later.